This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. On October 31st, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit granted Mayor Bloomberg's motion to stay the remedial decision in Floyd versus City of New York, a federal class action lawsuit filed against the NYPD and the City of New York that challenges the NYPD's practices of racial profiling and unconstitutional stop and frisks. They also remanded the case to the district court to assign a new judge.
Now, what does this decision mean for the continuation of stop and frisk, that concerted, pernicious manifestation of racial stereotyping and criminalization of entire communities? And what does the decision mean for Judge Shara Sheindlin, who or other judges who merely made public statements responding to critics of their rulings?
We're joined now by Bayer Asmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Well, I want to start with what has come to light now, which is most interesting, and that is that a number of daily newspapers indicated that they were shopped dossiers that were compiled by the City of New York rather early on to effectively smear Judge Shara Sheindlin. So what do you think are the implications for adjudicating difficult and controversial, indeed provocative cases, given the ruling by the Second Circuit that removes Judge Sheindlin from the stop and frisk case?
The implications are startling because this administration, anyway, and we should only hope that the de Blasio administration would not replicate this practice. But this administration has been notorious for attempting to smear judges that are ruling against them, in other words, where they can't sort of win on the merits, particularly in cases involving issues of racial justice. They simply publicly and also privately engage in a whisper campaign to undermine the partiality of particular judges. They did it in our Vulcan's firefighter case. They did it again with Judge Sheindlin, rather than defend their actions on the merits, which ultimately, as Judge Shara Sheindlin found, were not defensible.
I just want you, since you mentioned the Vulcans case, just for a second, just cue people into what that was about and what happened to the judge in that case.
Yeah, this is a case that we brought on behalf of a society of African-American firefighters called the Vulcan Society, challenging a 30-year pattern and practice of racial discrimination by the City of New York. Mayor Bloomberg was simply outraged that we would dare to do this. He constantly criticized the federal judge in that case, Judge Garifas in the federal court in Brooklyn, and argued he was biased. And the Second Circuit affirmed 90% of Judge Garifas' ruling that the city was engaged in racial discrimination, but for some minor proceedings on remand, assigned it to a different judge. I think as a function of a lot of the work the city had done to sort of question Judge Garifas's integrity.
Now, from what I understand, this stays the remedial decisions of Judge Sheindlin, but doesn't contradict the liability decisions, and that would be stayed until the appeal is heard sometime in April. Walk us through that process.
Yeah, that's right. So as a technical matter, the judge did two things. First, she found the city engaged in a widespread pattern and practice of unconstitutional stops and frisks, and both because they violated the Fourth Amendment and were effectively racial profiling. And then she issued a separate order telling the city what they had to do to remedy this process and requiring them to meet with an independent monitor engage with community groups and the like. The city sought to basically put on hold this critical remedial process, and that's what the court granted that request and has stayed their obligation to do anything to reform these practices until there can be a hearing on the first part of what Shinlin ruled, the liability ruling, finding that the city had engaged in unconstitutional conduct, which is currently planned will happen in 2014.
I just want to return to the issue of Judge Shinlin for a moment, because people generally have a sense that there is an inherent violation of the professional code of responsibility for a judge to in any way, subsequent to a decision, speak on the case. And what I indicated that Judge Shinlin had done was actually respond to critics relevant to and just fleshed out the details of her ruling. Mm-hmm. So is it your understanding that there's any impropriety per se relevant to the, I mean, there was a 9-week trial in this case and a very, very comprehensive decision. So
exactly.
How do we understand the behavior of the judge in any event?
Right. Absolutely. This is one of the smartest, most well-respected, hardest working judges in a very competent judicial branch here in the Southern District of New York. She held a 9-week trial. She heard testimony from over 100 witnesses, 8,000 pages of transcripts, wrote a 200-page opinion, and all of that was at, you know, the highest level of competence and integrity. She did talk to the press, but you're exactly right. There is absolutely no prohibition on speaking to the press. The only prohibition is to speaking to the press about the merits of a case before you, and she never ran afoul of that rule. In fact, the code of judicial conduct requires judges to defend the integrity of the judicial system when it's under attack. So when she responded to the mayor's below-the-belt comments against her, or gave interviews to Jeffrey Toobin to explain her perspective on the balance between criminal prosecutions and the Bill of Rights, she was defending the judicial branch and shedding important light on how this branch functions, and is absolutely not prohibited.
The other thing that the appeals court mentioned was that she steered the case to her court. Now, how common is that behavior, and did she act in any way that other judges don't?
Judges do this all the time. It's so entirely routine, it's hard even to quantify. You know, to be and to sort of explain what happened, CCR had brought an earlier case called Daniels versus City of New York, in which we challenged the police department's racial profiling and demanded that they impose a racial profiling policy. In 2003, we went to court saying that they hadn't abided by the settlement agreement. We asked the judge to keep the Daniels case over. It was scheduled to expire. She agreed with the city and denied our request to keep the case open. She rejected what we went into court asking us to do, and she said something, she told us to do something different, something much harder. She simply said, file a new case and file it as related, and I will take it as related. Now, you know, out of context, that might look somehow untoward, but it's so entirely routine, and of course the cases were related. They should have been heard together. It would have been foolish for her to just invite, you know, this to go into the wheel and go to another judge, given that the cases were identical, and judges are obligated to take cases as related when it would save judicial resources. The cases are so related that evidence of the city's violation of the settlement agreement in the Daniels case was expressly part of the trial in the Floyd case.
And there are a number of cases. There is the Davis case, which is one that the Legal Aid Society is in. But it's almost obligatory to, if there is a related issue, albeit perhaps it may take place within the context of public housing versus the streets or community at large, et cetera, to see, again, for judicial economy, that it is given to a judge. As a matter of fact, the asbestos cases, the cases around various welfare supplements for people who are seeking an enhanced shelter allowance to pay their rent, all of these are given carte blanche to the judge, who develops a level of expertise, et cetera. So it's kind of, as you said, really as common as apple pie.
You wouldn't want it any other way. And I would note the irony of the Court of Appeals decision, among many other dangerous ironies, is this was a panel of three judges that was sitting only to hear motions. And yet, as part of their order, they ordered that they also will hear the merits of the appeal. Why? Because in their judgment, the merits is related to the issues on the motion. So they did exactly what they were chastising Judge Shindlin for doing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to flesh out, the fact that there actually was not even a motion relevant to this that was before the circuit court.
Yeah.
I found that, you know, quite extraordinary that it's really acting on its own, and I'll use the word in brackets, or really in quotes, discretion to have engaged such a severe rebuke of a judge, particularly when there was no motion relevant to any impropriety or conduct abuse of the judge. But Ken asked you something a bit earlier that I was hoping you would flesh out a bit more, because I'm not sure that people understand. Ken made the distinction between the remedial and the liability. Tell us, actually, refresh our memories as to what the court actually held relevant to the issue of remedial implementation after finding that it was unconstitutional, that is, racial profiling. So if you could take us through the holding again, that would be helpful.
You would like to hear the why she found the city liable, or what remedies she wanted to
impose? Ken was indicating, and that there's this kind of bifurcation in the decision, that the liability component is intact. So let's just figure out what that liability was. And it's really the remedial component. What are those two things?
Yeah, so the liability component is a judgment based on these, 9 weeks and 100 witnesses that the city, one, engaged in a widespread pattern and practice of stops and frisks without the required level of what we call under the Fourth Amendment reasonable suspicion, and that line officers were stopping people routinely in response to quota pressure from high-level commanders in the NYPD. And there was overwhelming evidence that stop and frisks were being done without the required level of suspicion, that officers were covering up the basis for stops and frisks, and that, as an aside, there was a hit rate that was astronomically low. In other words, the program is justified on the grounds that it's supposedly designed to get guns off the street, but guns were recovered out of the 4.2 million stops our expert studied. Guns were recovered in 0.14% of stops, a rate that's lower than you'd get if you did a random checkpoint. So, and then the second part of her ruling was not only are they stopping people without, the required level of suspicion, what's actually motivating the stop and frisk practices is a racial profile, and that the city is not only just sending officers into high-crime neighborhoods, a practice we don't contest, but that they're operating on a particular profile, which came out repeatedly at the trial, of young male black, and that they're instructing their officers to target their activities based on perceived propensity of African Americans to commit more crime, and not based on any actual, you know, suspicious behavior. So that was the liability ruling, and again, it was based on overwhelming evidence, and I should say, evidence that sort of corresponded with the experiences and the public knowledge that has been accumulating over the past decade. This was not some obscure, you know, legal ruling. This maps completely with what hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers experience in front of their faces every day. And so to remedy that process, she appointed an independent monitor that would require the after doing expert consultations, require new training, new supervision, new discipline procedures. And in a piece that, you know, we thought really impressive, she created what she called a joint remedial process, where all the relevant stakeholders, community groups, the unions, anyone sort of affected could come together through a facilitated process and talk about how to meaningfully change the NYPD.
The police unions have filed for an intervention. I assume that is to get some kind of status in the case. Does that have to do with the possibility that our probable Mayor de Blasio would not appeal the case, would turn down the appeal?
I think that's what I think the union is trying to intervene because they are concerned that the city, under the new mayorship, might not pursue the appeal. After all, that is what Mayor de Blasio has said, and I hope people hold himself to that promise. So they, as sort of independent from the city, hope to try and continue to challenge the liability ruling, even if he withdraws the appeal. We think that's wholly improper and are challenging that possibility, but that lurks out there as well.
I find it quite remarkable. There was, again, a 9-week trial, 23,000 pages of evidence and 8,000 pages of trial transcript. I mean, there was such a comprehensive and thorough review before and dealt with by Judge Scheindlin. But it's still an amazing thing to me. I remember early on, it was maybe April or May or thereabouts, where the mayor's office, talking about improprieties, actually again did this dossier and review of Judge Scheindlin. And one of the things they mentioned is that she had ruled against law enforcement in 60% of her 15 written search and seizure rulings since she took the bench in 1994. Again, I find that just an enormous pressure and smear tactic in trying to really create hysteria around the absolutely flawless, spotless, remarkable, fair adjudication by Judge Scheindlin, given the evidence that was presented to her. One of the other things that I'm interested in is actually, the case at this juncture, correct me if I'm wrong, has been given to Judge Kotel. Our listeners may know Judge Kotel as the judge that had the case of compassionate release of attorney Lynn Stewart, which he turned down. But am I correct? Is Judge Kotel now, regardless of the situation, effectively in control of the appeal?
Actually, since it was originally appointed Judge Kotel, it was bounced from him, I think for probably purely administrative reasons, to a relatively recent Obama appointee named
Annalisa Torres.
Yeah. Mm. And so if we are unsuccessful in getting the Second Circuit decision to disqualify Shindlin, if we're unsuccessful to get that, you know, that reversed, the Judge Torres would oversee the remedial process, which is not a particularly, actually is a terribly inefficient process. I mean, Judge Shindlin heard, as we've, you know, we've talked about over and over again, months and months of testimony, and at this point has developed an expertise. She should be the one to implement the remedy. But if we don't get that piece of the Second Circuit's decision reversed, it'll be this new Judge Torres.
Well, I know that papers, I believe, are due, responding papers, November 14th. I hope those papers don't have to be reviewed too carefully, because it would be nice if a mayor-elect, Mr. William de Blasio, continues what he has peripherally stated, and that is the withdrawal of the appeal, and we can move forward with a different set of policies and practices that are not inherently constitutional, which is what Judge Shindlin found. I really have to commend the Center for Constitutional Rights for the enormous, important work that they have done on this case, certainly along with friends from the New York Civil Liberties Union, Legal Aid Society, the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, but certainly steering it, CCR. And Bear Asmi, thank you very much for joining us, Nina. And just maybe in 30 seconds, if Bill de Blasio does not withdraw the appeal, are you confident that there will be ultimately a remedial component that is not dissimilar from what Judge Shindlin sought to institute in her holding?
I'm hopeful, but I can't say I'm confident, because appeals, as we just saw, are always risky business, which is why everyone needs to hold the future mayor, Mr. de Blasio, accountable and demand that he withdraws his appeal and we move towards meaningful reforms finally.
Bear Asmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Heaven, can't you see? Look into the streets. Sirens in my sleep get the best of me. My brothers are dying. Is there anybody trying? Devils in a blue dress.
I see Rudy Giuliani runs this mob like a mafia don. And this mob's called the NY Police Squad. Devils in the blue dress, they backed by the King Pataki. Glide like warriors and sting like a German Nazi. Earth's the burning grounds below heaven and angels. They put a Glock slug in the back of Kevin to Daniel. I see a black man on death row simply for defending himself against the devil. Yo, his name's Mumia, political slave. These sick days are grave before the day the victimized Mumia. It's real, on Christmas Day they co-shot William Whitfield, the pigs peeled. Did they consider it a big deal? It's about time they locked up Lavoti. Put him with my homies. I bet the devil got an eye for me. Bet these lyrics got him really vexed. But to be damned by the devils, to be truly blessed.
While brothers are dying, is there anybody trying? Devils in a blue dress.
As dark clouds follow, I think of Amadou Diallo, and it's still a hard pill to swallow. How can the acts of men be so cold, taking the life of any.
Well, and the policies do continue, which is one of the reasons that we sincerely hope that the holding of Judge Shindlin, which was so thoroughly drafted, rendered with such a broad swath of testimony, etc., is ultimately capable of being implemented and really seriously changing the unconstitutional practice of stop and frisk. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.